This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
Coming up right now is The Space Show. Welcome to The Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I am Andrew Rennie, and on the panel tonight we have Mission Control. Yes, on my way out in space somewhere. We have Richard. On this evening's The Space Show, Apollo 13 and Australia. We have part two of our story on how Australians helped save the crew of the crippled moon mission. Turning back now, time is sure. Baby, if I could turn back time, if I could find a way, if I could turn back time, if I could turn back time. Last week we were discussing Apollo 13 and how Australians were involved in the rescue of the astronauts and brought them back safely home. Well, tonight we are going to continue. We're going to hear now from John Saxon, Mike Dinn, and how they had trouble separating the signal from the rocket, the Saturn IVb, and from the lunar module. And they were on close frequencies. The Saturn IVb was heading towards an impact of the moon, and the lunar module, of course, was heading towards the far side of the moon. So let's hear this conversation that was led by Peter Owood, the former president of the Space Association of Australia.
What I thought I'd do is bring in some of the other participants now and talk about what was going on. You're obviously very busy over in Houston, but there was a lot of activity going on in Australia at that time. And John, Mikey, want to talk to what was happening in Tibimbilla and the rest of Australia?
Well, my recollection was after the explosion, someone came on. We hadn't quite acquired then. It happened in Goldstone's View. We were about half an hour, I think, from acquisition. But the first thing was a call from somebody at Houston saying, hey, can we get Parks up? And I said, well, no, it's not scheduled for this mission. The moon was too far north. And they said, oh, well, Mr. Kraft will be calling your director shortly. Now, I wasn't privy to that, but I gather Chris Kraft called Tom Reed, or Don Gray, actually, it was at that time, and wheels went into motion very quickly. We were, again, not directly involved, but the PNG was fired up to get microwave links all up and working. The Park CSIRO people, by sheer good luck, there were quite a few people physically at Parks who were capable of reconfiguring. The whole idea of Parks, of course, was the extra gain on the one hand and the narrow beam width of the big dish on the other. Because, Joe, you probably wouldn't have appreciated it at the time, but we did have the S4B still transmitting at this stage on the same frequency as the lunar module. And that really was a big, big problem from our point of view. So that's my main recollection of that particular. Oh, and a team was put on an aeroplane led by Bruce Window within, a couple of hours of the request and flown on a private plane to Parks to staff up Parks. So a big, big effort by many, many people to get the comms working in the Australian environment. And the Parks dish had a beam width of about 0.1 of a degree. 0.1 degree, whereas the 85 foot was about 0.3 of a degree. So a hope was that one could separate the S4B signal from the lunar module signal angularly. I don't honestly think we really achieved that. because by the time everything was up and go, I think the S4B was relatively close to the moon. So that's my bit of the background. John, you got anything to add?
And of course, Parkes is simply that, a receiver. Unlike the movie The Dish, you can't transmit from Parkes, if I'm not mistaken, gentlemen.
That's right. Anyway, that's right.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Does John have anything to add?
Well, I was just going to say that we haven't mentioned so far that because we had to acquire one or the other of the spacecraft first, like either the S4B or the CSM, sorry, the LEM, and it was a real problem tuning the uplink transmitter to pull the downlink signal away from the other vehicle, and it was so bad that at one point we had to ask Houston to get the astronauts to switch off the lunar module, and this was so we could acquire the S4B, pull it off to one side, and then acquire the LEM when they switched it back on again. And I don't think Houston were terribly impressed when we suggested that at this time we were somewhat in extremis, or the mission was.
That was a particularly dramatic decision from my point of view, that we got the signals separated, and then Houston comes up and says, oh, we want to tune one or the other, can't remember which. And we all knew instantly that that was going to screw things up again. And I had anybody and all the USB people and everybody shouting in my ear saying, no, don't. So I went back to Mrs. Chu and says, well, don't do that. It's going to mess things up. And I got it on the line and they backed me up. In the end, Mr. Houston said, do it. So we did it. And everything we forecast occurred, screwed up the uplink, and therefore the only way out of that mess was, as John said, to ask the command module to turn itself off, which was rather a catastrophic request at that stage. And I only found out about 2 years ago why that was requested. It turned out that Houston could only process our tracking data if the transmitter was on its nominal frequency. Can't go into the technicalities of that, but so they could not process the tracking data unless the transmitter was on the center frequency, which is where we did not want to be from a comms point of view. Anyway, another time and place and go into that detail.
My understanding is, and forgive me because I really don't know much about this, but the S4B stage was planned to crash into the moon. It had a transmitter on it, which was in fact on the same frequency as the lunar module. Is that correct?
That's correct. But it was more than that. They added extra batteries on that particular mission to be able to track the S4B to lunar impact, get accurate tracking data. So the S4B and its transponder were normal fit. It's just that on Apollo 13, they added extra batteries. That's my understanding.
And can I just add there, Mike, the reason you could pull the two apart was that the transponder on the spacecraft, whichever one it was, would follow the uplink frequency as you changed it. So you could move one away from the other. Is that correct?
It was a phase lock system. And just by the by, I happen to have had a little bit of sort of a mini experience of this in my Tibimbilla days. It looked at one stage that if we would have had two surveyors on the moon transmitting on the same frequency, surveyors 2 and 4. But in practice, it never really happened. But we did run simulations at Tibimbilla to cope with two S-band signals on the same frequency. So I had some confidence that the tuning of the signal one way and the tuning of the signal the other way would work.
So, Joe, this probably would have all been completely invisible to you back in Houston in the Mission Control Center. Is that right?
That is true. I had no idea that was going on.
Right.
And of course, it was always low signal. And as Joe has said, we all had the joy of listening to the lots and lots and lots of hiss and noise. The voice was such a low level, everybody had to work damned hard just to pick out the audio.
Mm-hmm.
I think the voice signal was below the noise. You had to sort of make quite a few assumptions about what was being said.
Wow.
Sorry, go ahead.
That was John Saxon, Mike Dinn, and a little bit there from Joe Curran in conversation with Peter Aylward, the space show's very own Peter. One interesting point to note there is that after the Saturn IV b had hit the moon, it sent seismic waves across the moon, and it was picked up by the Apollo 12 seismometer, the earthquake detector, if you like, or moonquake detector, that was landed by Apollo 12 in November of 1969. And Jim Lovell, when told of this, said, well, at least one thing worked on this mission. Now we're going to go to Fred Hayes. Peter had a conversation with Fred for the space show, and he was asked about the reaction on seeing the damage done to the service module of Apollo 13 by that oxygen tank explosion. They were, of course, looking at it from the point of view of the command module and the lunar module were still attached to each other, and the service module was now drifting away. Here's how that conversation went.
Fairly shortly before the re-entry, you disconnected from the lunar module and then the command module. Actually, the command module, the service module.
Service module first, yeah.
We've all seen a couple of those photographs that were hastily taken.
Right.
What was it like for you eyeballing that and seeing the damage?
Well, I was surprised because looking at that degree of damage and thinking back to the explosion, the explosion had not seemed that severe.
Right.
The amount of, one quarter of the spacecraft blown off, a lot of wiring loose that was broken, thermal blankets had been torn apart. You could see some of the leftover torn segments of that. So, no, the explosion, I would have thought, would have been more extreme, both felt and heard, than we had for that amount of damage. I'm assuming that was, again, because when this happened, we were in a vacuum of space, so there was no secondary air shockwaves like would happen here on Earth. Some of the probably bigger effects of explosion on Earth are not just the immediate flash of the explosion, but those secondary air shockwaves.
And we'll have more from Fred Hayes, Apollo 13 astronaut, coming up in this week's The Space Show. But first, now to some poetry. Elizabeth Black wrote the poem Apollo 13, and we're reading it here for her.
Apollo 13 by Elizabeth Black. The curved hem of our planet, resting regally in a black void, this view never gets old, I think to myself as I stare out my little triangular window. Far, far below, swirling clouds glide heavily over the ground, masking glass oceans. I look down upon heaven, an odd thought, really anything to pass the time until the next maneuver. I always wanted to leave, to place my small step on the surface of the moon. The Earth regards me resentfully. I apologize. The Earth shrinks slightly as our spacecraft drifts away. With the final frontier comes distance. Naturally, I've run away from home. I stare at that relentless orb sitting in the sky. I make a note or two in my journal. I see someone else floating above and looking down, someone else, not me, crazily doubting the stars and the ship, longing to go back. Easier said than done, I suppose.
If you look out to the west, you can see the crescent moon right now, getting very low in the sky, And tomorrow it'll be higher in the sky and less of a crescent. So well worth a look. Now, back to Fred Hayes and his description to Peter Arwood for the space show of the re-entry and splashdown.
Many people talk about the launch, describe the launch, these feelings, what's going on. Not that many people talk about the re-entry, and perhaps you'd like to talk through the re-entry from your perspective. And one question I have is, I don't believe you were fully suited up during the re-entry. Is that correct? And why would that be? In case, like,
I would probably what?
You were not fully suited up?
No. They had decided early on after the success of Apollo 7 not to suit up. By then, you know, you're pretty sure of the cabin integrity. And so it's really not felt to be a...
Even with your vehicle having had an explosion, I thought that would have maybe been an extra bit of insulation.
Oh, no, we'd have lost the cabin pressure long before entry.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
So tell me about the re-entry to the Earth from
space. Well, I guess I can give a pretty good description because I was just an innocent bystander. I didn't have much to do in the right couch. Jim and Jack were more involved with worrying about the guidance, nav, and control performance through that. And so I got to look out the window all the way, and it's an interesting view because you're looking backwards. You're looking behind you. As it starts biting in, the first thing that's unusual was there was kind of a white glow in the spacecraft from the air being ionized around you as you hit the upper, very upper atmosphere, only not many particles, very thin atmosphere, and it ionized those components going 25,000 miles an hour as you barreled in, and it caused this white glowing effect. Now, it didn't last long. And very quickly, then it started getting a red, fiery trail behind you, fairly bright red. And it was kind of pretty when the automated guidance, nav, and control system rolled. That's the way it controlled range, was to roll the vehicle. It was very aerodynamically, it was locked in and pitching yaw with that blunt capsule. So roll was the only control you had, and to affect range control. And as it rolled, you get a little swirl pattern in that bright red trail. And as you got in a little deeper, the trail started being less red and more toward, call it a brownish red. And finally, just almost a brown lighter red trail of smoke, literally like trailing you. And then it got down to just now almost a white smoke trail about the time the drogue chutes deployed at roughly 60,000 feet, which tended to jerk a little bit as they popped open, but obviously were out to stabilize the capsule to keep it going blunt end first as you went on down. And there was another jolt at 10,000 feet, and you kind of lost that whole trail by then. There wasn't any trail behind you. And then the main chutes deployed, and they went to a reefed position, otherwise they didn't fully deploy. And that was when you really knew and felt you were going to be home okay, when you got the mains. You could see them, and we had all three out, actually. And they unreefed and blossomed all the way. And so we were in good shape then, I knew, to splash down. The splashdown itself was not as bad as I expected. Apollo 12 before us had had a very hard splashdown. I think it broke a bracket. It was on the window with a camera.
Oh, yes.
And actually hit Al Bean's head on the way down to the floor. And I think the landings were affected by how much, what the winds were, what the wave state was, sea state was, and how the thing may be swinging a little bit and how you hit a wave as you crashed into the ocean.
Sure.
And our landing was, comparatively to what I expected, was a very easy landing. We settled in. Jack had thrown the switches to get rid of the... Jim, I'm not sure who threw the switch, Jack or Jim. But to get rid of the parachute before it pulled us over upside down, which you wanted to try to avoid. So we just sat there finished a checklist. As a checklist, you go through to safe the capsule. While meanwhile, the Navy divers are doing their thing outside to get the inflatable shroud around the spacecraft. And they actually knock on the window when they've done their thing to let you out. And they open the hatch. They got a tool. They can open it. And they open it to let you out to get into the raft.
Find some fresh air. So, was there much sound in the spacecraft on the reentry? Was the air rushing around you?
Was there much what sound?
The sound.
No.
Was it very loud?
No. Not a lot of sound. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that was Fred Hayes, one of the three astronauts aboard the crippled Apollo 13, describing their entry there in conversation with the space show's Peter Arwood.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where the space show is looking back to the Apollo 13 mission that happened 55 years ago. Now, the Apollo 13 mission has attracted a lot of attention in popular media. We're going to give you an example of it now. This is about a guy, the singer, who's so in love that if they follow each other, they will, like Apollo 13, explode. This is The Tears with Apollo 13.
90 seconds and counting.
As you recall, you're not the one. You don't belong to the world that I'm from. Your lazy words blow like confetti in the wind. In the wind, as you recall, you're not part of my scene. Your feet don't belong near my upholstery. Sometimes I sink when you call me on the phone, on the phone.
The moon. Oh, yeah.
that I'm from.
That song by The Tears was recorded 20 years ago, yes, in 2005, Apollo 13. Now, let's move on to, or back to, Fred Hayes. And he has high praise for the folks at Honeysuckle Creek. Let's take a listen.
I mentioned we powered down, I figured to power down to 18 amps.
Uh-huh.
The people on Mission Control actually figured a way to get us down to 12 and a half amps.
Right.
One of the things that got us there was to enlist the help of the some of the big dish operators around the world who normally service JPL and the deep space probes, and one being Honeysuckle Creek in Australia. Now, I've talked many times, email still a lot, Colin McKellar, and he said they were asked to change their station to be compatible with our S-band communication, which they were not compatible with at the time. And he said they worked literally, our crews worked through the night, didn't go to sleep at all, to convert that station. And now with the bigger dish signal strength provided, we could turn off our power amplifier on board the spacecraft. That saved 2.5 amps.
Wow.
Which adds up. If you take 2.5 amps over 100 hours, that's a lot of amp hours. You know,
you kind
of. So it really was a big, big jump that allowed us to go down. Things like that allowed us to go down to that lower power level. And then in essence, we were providing communication and high bit rate data from the moon, where we were effectively without the power amplifier, and we only providing half an amp, 30 volts. So with 15 watts from the moon, we were providing high bit rate and communication.
If you would like to know more about Apollo 13 and Australia's involvement, then we here at the Space Show strongly recommend you visit Colin McKellar's excellent website. It's all about Honeysuckle Creek, the tracking station, and Colin has amassed an amazing collection of stories about the station and the people who ran it. The people's stories are actually more interesting than the station stories. There is an entire section devoted to the 55th anniversary of Apollo 13, including an excellently researched and written essay by Hamish Lindsay, the late author of the definitive book about Apollo, titled Tracking Apollo to the Moon. So point your web browser at honeysucklecreek.net. Now, Honeysuckle Creek is all one word lowercase, honeysucklecreek.net. And be prepared to spend hours browsing around on that excellent website. That's honeysucklecreek.net. And if you can't remember that, just type into your web browser, just Honeysuckle Creek, and you'll find it comes up near the top of the search list. Well, now to a poem by Nina Dolores. This will take me longer to announce than it actually runs for. As you hear, it's called Apollo 13, Serendipity.
Apollo 13, Serendipity by Nina Dolores. Objective: the moon mishap in transit, lives forfeit far from Earth trajectory, home.
I told you it was short. So let's go on now to some more music about Apollo 13. Yes, it's featured quite large in popular culture, not to mention the Ron Howard movie, Apollo 13. So this is by Audio Spectro. It comes from 10 years ago. Again, it's called Apollo 13.
We're back to Earth. ogni o da ogni bambino. Se son così vicino che che lune ancora, esplorazione, evolvere, zona di ripopolamento e cattura, attirati da orbite, questa capsula divora, uomo pelle e polvere, Houston qui c'è un problema, primi di vertigine. Senza ossigeno nei moduli, solo costellazioni.
Confirming that they dumped all of their fuel successfully.
An applause as Apollo 13 on main chutes comes through loud and clear on the television display here.
Audio Spectro with Apollo 13, bringing to a close our 55th anniversary feature here on the Space Show of the successful recovery of Apollo 13.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.